The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Welcome to a weekend bonus episode of the Tech Meme Ride Home. I'm Brian McCullough. Hope you all are having a lovely Sunday. I wanted to talk to Dave Bittner this week of CyberWire because the CyberWire family of podcasts are my go-to source for keeping up with the security space in general. And I'm glad I did get to speak to Dave because he's a super knowledgeable pro. And we get into things like those huge credential dumps recently, password best practices, and that Triton virus that has me so worried. But we started off by going on a weird tangent about Facebook, where I somehow found myself arguing for Facebook for some reason. And we ended by going really off the rails and talking about the Fermi paradox and aliens. It ended up being a really fun chat, I think. Please check out the CyberWire podcasts wherever you get your pods. Enjoy. I guess what everybody is talking about today vis-a-vis Facebook is that they say they've got to set aside X number of billion dollars to pay an expected FTC fine, and yet the stock goes up and investors are cheering. I'm not surprised by that. Are you?
I'm not surprised by it, but I would say I'm disheartened by it. That is the cold calculation that is made by investors these days, that I guess removing consideration of whether something or not is the right thing to do. It's really, how is this going to affect our bottom line? And I suppose you could make arguments that is what they are supposed to do. But just, you know, for me personally, I find that a little bit distressing.
Well, I mean, you have to understand the psychology of the investor class, and it's all about, okay, removing risks, unknown unknowns, and things like that. So essentially what Facebook telegraphed is the size of the fine, so that in an investor's mind, okay, this is a quantifiable thing that I know about, and so it's not an unknown out there. So right, that's the thing. It's instructive to know these things about investor psychology, so that even if a company announces horrible losses or something, if investors didn't know the size of that loss, just knowing can send a stock up, even if it announces something horrible.
Right. Now, that's an excellent point. Removing some of that uncertainty, it puts them at ease.
Yeah. And then, also, given that, on the day that they announced record Q1 revenue, if the fine does come down in the neighborhood that they're telegraphing, well, it's a drop in the bucket. It's easy to handle.
Right. And again, I think that's one of the frustrating parts for folks who would hope that these sorts of fines could cause change. Does this hurt enough for Facebook? We saw a story in the Washington Post this week that Senator Wyden, he's a Democrat from Oregon, he's a ranking member of the Senate Finance Committee. He's been talking about going after Mark Zuckerberg himself, making him individually liable for some of these privacy violations. That's interesting in itself.
Yeah, and there has been talk, too, about it was either the FTC or the Justice Department that was looking at past statements and things like that. I don't know. I don't know why all of a sudden I'm finding myself like playing devil's advocate here. But the argument can be made that we are already seeing change. It's just not the change that would give you catharsis where, I come to you, palms turned upwards, and I'm sorry for what we've done in the past, and we're going to shut down these lines of business that you think are creepy. No, they're changing to, in theory, a different business model of just messaging, encryption, and privacy and all that stuff. Again, it might not give you the catharsis you want, but it is change, right?
It's change if you believe that they're actually going to do that. And I'm not convinced that they are. At this point, I have trouble believing anything that comes out of Facebook because just living in a evidence-based world that, you know, that time and time again, every time they say they're sorry, you just wait and the clock starts ticking and news breaks about some other privacy violation.
Yeah, but okay, so you're definitely in the camp then, you're saying, of people who are like, well, this is all just a bunch of PR-friendly smoke and mirrors to buy time to keep doing what they've always done.
I suspect that's the case, yeah.
So, that again, this is funny. I can't believe that I'm on the other side of this right now.
Well, why? What makes you think what makes you take that side? Why do you think it could happen?
The one thing that I have 100% faith in, it's that Mark Zuckerberg has always based running this company 100% on metrics. Like in my book, I there's that famous anecdote that like early on, like in the first couple months of running the company, they could tell with like 90% accuracy if two users were going to be in a relationship or not, just based on like the interactions that they saw on Facebook. Mm. So I believe 100% that they're seeing overall usage declining. And again, that's not borne out in the actual like daily or monthly active user numbers or anything like that. But they will know sooner than any of us. They will have known for maybe 2 years now that the average people in North America are sharing less, using less, time spent on less. They can see the data that, and he's been very public about this, about that things are moving towards stories and things like that. So I do believe that he will always skate to where the puck is going because he has that information sooner than anybody else.
Hmm. Yeah.
It just so happens that if I don't know for sure that we'll end up in the business model that they're describing, moving to more of a messaging-based company, more of a everything behind encryption company, that just so happens to dovetail with things that buy them a little bit of PR. And just so happens, if that was the business model, it would be harder for people to blame them for stuff. But also, I do think this is the thing that put me over the edge with this. Mm. I believe that their experiments in crypto are real. And they can see, again, Zuck always looks at all the competitors. Sometimes he, you know, buys companies so he can spy on other competitors and see what's popular. They're looking at all these super apps in China and Asia where everybody is living their entire lives inside the apps. And it's how you get around. It's how you do your banking. It's how you do all your buying. And so when they talk about, like, on the earnings call that, like, in the future, the majority of our revenue could come from commerce, I think that that's skating to where the puck is going.
Hmm. I think that's interesting, and I'll share just another personal anecdote. You know, earlier this week, in fact, I saw a friend of mine on Facebook, someone who I went to college with. You know, she was raising money for a nonprofit, something that she supported, and she said, you know, please help me with this. And I thought, well, that's something I'm interested in, and I'd like to help my friend. And I clicked through in it, and it was Facebook asking me for my credit card information. Mm. And I stopped short, and I said, the last thing in the world I'm going to do is share my credit card information with Facebook. Now, that's just me. And, you know, you can tell based on our conversation that, you know, my hackles are a bit up when it comes to Facebook. But I wonder, I guess what I'm trying to get to is that you can't underestimate that trust is a component in how much people are going to allow Facebook to have their access to so many different parts of people's lives. I think people are on the defensive and leaning back a little bit right now, and it'll be interesting to see how that plays out and continues.
Yeah, and listen, I mean, none of my listeners have to be convinced that I am as exasperated by Facebook as anyone. So again, I don't know how I ended up playing devil's advocate there. One thing that I wonder if you could, shifting gears a bit here,
yeah,
if you could give me some more information on, because this is really outside my realm of knowledge. And sometimes to me, things like, you know, this new exploit seems like every other exploit I've heard of, or this new, you know, virus seems like every other, but this Triton thing.
Mm, yeah.
I'm wondering if you have any more, if you could do a knowledge dump of any degree to me about Triton, because this one seems like the scariest thing I've heard in the realm of cybersecurity in a long time.
It has the potential to be very bad. The folks that I've spoken to about it, particularly Robert M. Lee over at Dragos, they're a industrial control system security company. And I think his message is, yes, this is serious, but let's not panic. This is certainly new. This is something to be concerned about, but you know, it's not the end of the world. What's happening with Triton, and some people also refer to it as Trisis, so if you're tracking this, you could see both of those names. There was a petrochemical plant in Saudi Arabia, according to reports, that in summer of 2017, they were having a situation with some of their safety control systems were switching into fail-safe mode. And what that means is, in these complex industrial systems where you have physical things happening, you have valves opening and closing, and you have chemicals and liquids and things and steam and so on and so forth running through the plant, they're designed in such a way that if something goes wrong or if a system can't figure out what's going on, it goes into a safe mode. It shuts the system down. The whole point is to not have anything get worse or to cause loss of life or the release of dangerous chemicals, all
it's
that kind of stuff.
It's literally a fail-safe.
That, you're right. Yeah, that, yeah. That is, I mean, it's funny. When this stuff started coming out about this story, I sort of connected the dots. I'd used the term fail-safe, as I think we all have, but I'd never really connected it to the actual physical world that, yeah, these are systems that are designed, when they fail, to be safe. And that's what's going on here. So what they discovered was, in this petrochemical plant, they were using a controller for some of their safety systems. It's a system called Triconics, and it's made by a company called Schneider Electric. They're a company out of France. And bad guys had gotten into this safety controller and had managed to modify its firmware, which is really the low-level controls of this actual piece of hardware. And they were able to gain control of it. They were able to load software onto it. They were able to monitor what was going on with it. They were able to make it do the things they wanted to have it do and report the things they wanted to have it report. The danger of this is that this is a safety controller. So if something goes wrong in the plant and the plant signals to the safety controller, hey, there's something wrong, please shut down these systems. Well, if bad guys have control of that safety controller, they can report back to the people who are monitoring this, hey, everything's fine, nothing's going wrong, everything's good. And meanwhile, things down on the plant floor might be going horrifically wrong.
Well, is it just that, or is the idea here also that it could trigger something to go bad? Like, could these systems also be used to, I don't know, cycle up something like in the nuclear reactor sort of analogy or something like that to cause some sort of a catastrophe?
I think theoretically that's within the realm of possibility. Anytime you have a piece of hardware like this that has access to the physical controllers in a plant, if someone has that type of control remotely, which is what Triton did, then you have the potential for sending rogue commands to those, but then also reporting to the monitoring systems, or hiding those commands from the monitoring systems, which can sort of be a double whammy.
And then, if I remember correctly, the most recent story I did on this, where they saw it in action again, it seemed like whoever was behind it wasn't actively trying to take control. It was more like they were burrowing in. They were trying hard not to be observed, but they were almost like trying to embed themselves. So it's almost like sleeper cell. Like once we know we're in here, then we'll just save this for when we need to use it.
Yeah, yeah. The term we use is battle space preparation.
There you go.
They were trying to not get caught. They got caught because some of the software they put in there triggered these Triconics safety controllers have, I guess, a self-auditing mode where they go in and they analyze themselves to make sure that nothing's changed. And the people who made this malware made a mistake. It got triggered, and that set the safety controller into a fail-safe mode, which is what caused the folks to take a closer look at it. And evidently, this happened more than once before they realized that there was somebody in the system. I want to say the evidence was that that the bad guys were in this network since around 2014. And folks are saying that it was some people are reporting that this was the Russians.
Right. That was going to be my next question. Like, who do we think is, like, is it a state actor? It doesn't feel like these are just random jerks from the dark web playing.
No.
Yeah.
No, because there's no money to be made here. We're not stealing credit cards. Mm. I suppose you could say could be a ransom.
Yeah.
There could be a ransom. You know, give us all your money or we'll blow up the plant. But that doesn't seem to be what's going on here. So with the sophistication that they've seen, I believe that they discovered some Cyrillic characters within the code. It's hard to know for sure because anybody can put Cyrillic characters
right.
in code, right?
That's so what you would do to cover your tracks, right?
Yeah. Right. It's exactly what they'd be expecting us to do, right? Yeah. So, but that's the most recent reporting that I've seen is that people seem to have a fair amount of confidence that that this was the Russians, and they're just trying to get in there so they have these capabilities if somewhere along the lines they feel as though they might need them.
Tax season is when I rebalance my main retirement portfolio, my dividend growth stock portfolio. I've been using Yahoo Finance, our sponsor today, to do that just this very week. For more than 25 years, Yahoo Finance has been the brand behind every great investor. Whether you're a seasoned investor or are looking for that extra guidance, Yahoo Finance gives you all the tools and data you need in one place. They are the number one finance destination, producing a holistic look at the financial news cycle, including breaking news, original editorial perspectives, analyst ratings, independent research, customizable charts, and so much more. Wouldn't it be great if you could see all of your investment and retirement accounts in one place? Well, with Yahoo Finance, securely link your brokerage accounts for a unified view of your wealth, including 401k and other investments. A comprehensive perspective is what sets apart great investors, and that's how Yahoo Finance ensures you have the insights to look at your wealth in its entirety. With a community of over 90 million users each month, their real strength is helping you on your way to financial success. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination. yahoofinance.com, that's yahoofinance.com. 10 seconds on the clock. How many things can you name that are always growing? How about your customer base? How about your business on Shopify? Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow, whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits. Shopify helps you sell everywhere, from their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Was just checking in on our Shopify store this morning, running flawlessly as it's done for nearly a decade now. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S., and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ride, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ride now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ride. All right, shifting gears radically again. okay. One of the other stories that I've done a couple times in the last few months from the security realm has been these mega dumps from the previous, I don't know, I guess it was the Yahoo one. But essentially, there's a couple of huge caches out there now that there are literally hundreds of millions of people's credentials out there. So essentially, basically, all of us have some account or credentials somewhere that were compromised, even if it was your MySpace from 2006 or something.
Yeah. Odds are you're in one of those. And of course, the Have I Been Pwned database is a great place to check that out, Troy Hunt's database.
So you turned me on to this great article that I hope I remember to put in the show notes. but this is actually, again, this is a wild shift of what we're actually considering here, but this has actually been a boon for analyzing the psychology of how people pick passwords and things like that. So again, there's this article that'll be in the show notes of, about looking at this and using this corpus of data to analyze. We're just going to, I'm actually just going to go down some of the things I found interesting. So we all know that obviously there's like 30 passwords that account for like a fourth of all the dumb passwords people use, you know, going from 1234 to 1111 to all that stuff. And then, you know, I guess I would have known this, but I'd never seen this written out before. Like if you're a hacker, if you just guess using the top 10 passwords, you're going to be successful something like 16 out of 1,000 times.
Right.
So it's super easy to have decent results just by relying on people's stupidity.
Right. And there are tools available that take advantage of these things. So you can hammer away at someone's password. And the first place that this tool starts is with all of the established, well-known, easy to crack passwords.
Right. And then like you can within, I don't know, 9 seconds, if you just run through everything, you can see, oh, I had 100,000 people and I got 6,000 out of that 100,000 or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
The thing, though, is that I found fascinating was even when people try to get a little more sophisticated, there's always patterns that are easily exploitable as well. So starting with, okay, I can't use, you know, whatever. I'll use whatever, but then I'll add a number to it. But then most people only add one digit. So that's really easy.
Right. Well, and because a lot of times you'll go to create a password and the organization will say there must be a digit. And what this study found is that 23% of people simply add a one to the end of their password.
And then patterns in a different way. So, you know, one of the most common passwords is QWERTY, you know, Q-W-E-R-T-Y. But then there's a ton of passwords where if you look at them on paper, they look like, well, that's a random string of whatever. But then if you look at a keyboard or whatever, it's really not. So you're not really being a genius if you do G-Y-H-U-J-I-K-O-L, because all you've done is gone up and down on a QWERTY keyboard, and probably a bunch of other people have done that same pattern.
Right. Right, and that pattern's going to be in the hit list for the cracking software.
Right, and then it's going to evolve because now people are having to create passwords on touch devices. But then again, so the patterns will just change. But then, you know, if you're thinking, like, imagine holding up a phone and having, you know, the number pad or whatever. And so then people will start doing an X, and then that'll look like a random string, but it's really just doing an X on you know, the number pad and things like that.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Well, I think that the take home for me out of this article, and I think this is really interesting research, so I recommend people check it out, is that no matter how clever you think you are with your password routine, and we've all established password routines for ourselves over the years, no matter how clever you think you are, you're not.
Yeah.
You are not clever. Someone else is. They figured it out. You're not the first person to do it. You're not the last. The best way to handle this is to use a password manager and have it generate random strings for you.
Right. And there was that one. They also got into like the passwords, you know, famous people use. And so like there was some Huffington Post editor or something that, you know, clearly an X-Files fan, did trust no one. Well, of course, how many other people that were of, you know, the era of X-Files did trust no one, but then they were clever because the O was a zero and the one was the number one. But again, it's the same sort of easy pattern. Okay, real quick, I loved these two little bits of these little nuggets here. People who use first names or their names and their year of birth in their addresses tend to skew toward men. But also people born in the 80s. I don't think the article had any reason for that. But
Well, I don't know. Being a child of the 80s and seeing that David was one of the top ones in there, I noticed Brian is not in there. So I guess you're out of the woods there. I don't know. We're kids of the 80s, that self-absorbed and I suppose I can't deny it, but it's an interesting little side note they made there.
Well, I was even wondering if it's, because then, again, it skewed more towards men. Is that like some sort of a weird male ego thing? It's like, you know, this is my year, this is my era, man, or something like that. But then, because then the other interesting thing that I made note of was like the gender differences are probably legion. Like in one of the sets of data, like, women are twice as likely to have the word love contained in their passwords than men, which is funny. But then that again, that comes back to patterns, because like they said in the research, you could, looking at the data, you could create these pools, and then just based on passwords, you could be like, well, this set of passwords is likely female users, likely of this age range, maybe even likely of this geographic region, that sort of thing.
Right. Right. So even simply based on your password, they can infer a bunch of things about you.
It's ironic that the thing that is supposed to be masking your identity and providing you privacy is, like anything else in this crazy data world, it's just another data point that can unmask you, really.
Yeah, yeah. It's an amazing time to be alive, Brian, isn't it?
Well, so two quick questions. You said, of course, Password Manager is the only viable option, but then it's only really useful if you do use the random password generator.
Yes.
And then... Yes.
Well, so, the other thing that a password manager does is it keeps tabs on you as to whether you're reusing passwords.
Right. And
it'll
then
say,
Well, and the point is that if you're going to use a password manager, at the very least, use the random password generator, and at the very least, make each one different, because that's the whole point of this. It's like how ships have those hulls, and ships are created so that if something gets compromised, the whole ship doesn't go down, and that's the whole point. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Then. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say then, and also, if something's important to you, use multi-factor authentication.
Right. How do you feel about the actual physical keys?
I like them. Yeah. I like them. It's something we use them here at CyberWire for some of our important things. With a password manager, with the keys like that, the initial resistance is, how much is this going to slow me down? How much of a pain is this going to be? And I'll say, having gone through the transitions to both a password manager and a physical key, it's really not that bad. And the amount of security you gain from them, worth it. So I recommend them.
And then using the actual authenticator apps like Authy and Gmail or Google Have is superior to SMS.
Correct.
Even though SMS, it's like a layered, this is better than nothing, this is better than that, this is better. So SMS is good, better than nothing.
Much better than nothing.
But it's still not perfect.
Correct. And the little authentication apps are even better.
And the reason for them being better is because, in theory, my SMS can be intercepted.
Correct. Okay. If someone wanted to bad enough, they could spoof your SMS and they could get the organization to send them that code and off they go.
Very last question then.
Yeah.
I have been told recently that... you don't necessarily have to do uppercase, lowercase, numbers, letters, random character, that actually you can do like three random letters separated by dashes. And that's better, I was told, because it encourages you to have greater entropy so that you'll have a password that's actually 20 characters long. Is that correct?
Correct.
Or have I been misinformed?
No, I think that's right on. Entropy is the thing. And this article talks about entropy and how they track it. I would say with passwords, longer is better. So stringing together a random series of words that you could remember is better than a single word and a series of numbers. The longer that password is, the more time it's going to take for someone to try to crack it, and the more likely they are to move on to the person who has the easier password than you.
Is it still true that if it's truly random and it's long enough, has enough entropy, that all of the computers in all of the world would still take 1,000 years and still, in theory, not be able to crack it? Is that still true? Does the math still win out in the end right now?
As far as I know, it does. When we get to some of these cryptographic routines, some of the experts I've talked to have said that you start bumping up against the laws of physics, where you know the amount of energy available in the universe starts to become a factor. If things are going to change, there's a lot of fear, or fear is probably not the right word for it. Well, some people are afraid about quantum computers coming online because they're going to be able to crack a lot of the encryption that we rely on these days that makes the web work. But we joke that quantum computers, it might be a lot like fusion energy, where it's always 20 years away, no matter when you ask. So we'll see.
Or AI, in theory.
Or yeah.
This will be a really weird way to end, but one of my obsessions is with the Fermi paradox. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Yes.
It's basically the question of how come we haven't met aliens yet if the universe is so large and so old.
Yeah.
And one of the theories has to do with computing, where once a civilization gets big enough and once computing resources get, like, you have an overheating problem like you're talking about, it's too much, and that's why you would build Dyson spheres and things like that. But one of the theories is that once you get that advanced, you have to go out into the very edges of space where it's super, super cold. Otherwise, your computers stop functioning.
That's interesting.
And so that's one of the theories for why we've never met aliens. Yes, aliens got super sophisticated 2 billion years ago, but to keep their computers running, they had to all migrate out to the coldest recesses of space, and basically that's why we don't see them, because we're still here where it's hot.
Oh, that's interesting. I would say, well, until you told me that, my favorite answer to the Fermi paradox is just that the distances are so great that unless someone comes up with faster than light travel, it's just impractical to have any sort of communication.
Now, see, we could do another episode about this, because if you do one of those, what do you call the probes, where if you just send a probe out and it takes 1,000 years to get to the next star system, and then you take 100 years just to gather the resources to send out another probe, the laws of exponential growth say that it would only take you approximately 200,000 years to basically colonize the entire Milky Way. So again, even though the distances are part of the problem with the Fermi paradox, the immense lengths of time that the universe has existed is also the problem, because given that, we shouldn't be alone. We should be in the middle of a huge metropolis at this point.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Anyway,
well, Brian, who says we're not? Get your heads out of the sand, sheeple.
Yes, well, that's because we're in the favorite one is we are in a why can't I think of it? We're in a simulation, and that's why.
Yes,
so there you go.
Yes, I'll tell you, man. Some days, ooh,
it certainly feels like it. All right, we got off the rails there, but in a fun way in the end. Thank you, Dave.
Yeah, my pleasure. Great talking to you.